To keep the peace, to pioneer the future, the new mission of your AAF. In cooperation with the American Broadcasting Company, the Army Air Forces present Your AAF, a report to the American people on its continuing operations today throughout the world and their adventures in research, which are pioneering for your better world tomorrow. Tonight you will hear from Wright Field, the AAF's vast research laboratory, an actual blind landing made by a pilot who never touched the controls. From Washington, Lieutenant Colonel Lewis T. Grayson, answering directly a mother's questions about her soldier son. From Japan, an interview with Generals Giles, LeMay, and O'Donnell before the first non-stop flight from Japan to the United States, and from Washington, the first radio pickup of their arrival. And as always, the singing voices in the orchestra of the AAF, bringing you the best of the top music of the day. And from the All Soldier Orchestra, it's a tune in the tempo of the times. Get happy. Field, Dayton, Ohio, the vast research laboratories of the AAF, backbone of American air might. Notable among Wright Field's achievements are the many safety devices developed during war to protect our airmen, all of which now become part of our daily lives. One of the most exciting of these is a device to land planes under any weather conditions entirely by radio control and without any assistance from the pilot. Your AAF takes you now by Army wire recorder to the completely hooded pilot's compartment of an Army plane now approaching Wright Field. To describe this landing, your AAF radio correspondent, Captain Bob Van Kamp. Go ahead, Captain.
This is your AAF reporter, Captain Bob Van Kamp, speaking from the pilot's compartment of the Blind Bat, a T-47 airplane flying at 2,000 feet, somewhere about 7 miles from Wright Field. In just a moment, we're going to attempt one of the most unusual broadcasts ever made. We're going to tell you just what happens as this great transport plane comes in for a completely automatic landing, without human hands touching the controls. The windshield of our blind bat is hooded by a black cloth. It's impossible to see outside. Our pilot, Captain Dick Orchard of Lakewood, Ohio, is going to use an automatic pilot, which has been coordinated with the standard instrument approach system of the AAF. The system was developed by the Air Technical Service Command to make airplane landings simpler and safer, regardless of weather conditions. At this moment, two different radio beams are being sent out from the runway area at Wright Field. One marks the center of the runway, and the other indicates the descending path that our plane should take for its landing. All Captain Orchard needs to do is get on these two beams and then put his plane on automatic pilot. Mechanical brains will do the rest. Let's listen now to the landing preparations underway.
Right tower, right tower. This is Blind Bat, over.
Blind Bat, this is Right Tower, over.
Right Tower, this is Blind Bat, 7 miles west at 2,000. Request clearance for automatic approach and landing. Over.
Blind Bat, this is Wright Tower. Blind Bat, this is Wright Tower. You are cleared for approaching landing. Over.
Wright Tower, this is Blind Bat. Roger, out.
Captain, what happens now that you're cleared by right field for this automatic landing? I'll turn on the automatic approach, and from now on, until we land, the Blind Bat will fly itself. Say, I can feel this airplane banking and turning as it gets set. That means the automatic pilot has taken hold, huh? What do you do now, Captain Orchard? All we have to do now is sit tight and watch the instrument panel and get ready for the final landing. Let's make our landing check now, Max.
Okay. Gear down and locked. High RPM, 20 degrees of flap. Booster pumps are on. Hydraulic pressure's up. Trim set.
On the instrument panel, a little vertical needle can be seen exactly centered on the indicator dial. That shows that we're right in line with the runway at right field. Another horizontal needle tells us that we're descending at just the right angle. That's where this automatic pilot has it all over manual landing. You know you're coming in just right.
Right tower. This is Brian Bat on final. Over.
Brian Bat, this is Right Tower. You're cleared to land. Over.
Right tower, this is Brian Bat. Roger, out.
How close are we now, Captain Orchard?
Less than 4 miles now, maybe 3.
How can you tell?
See this light just above the indicator?
Uh-huh.
It flashed 2 times a second just before I called the tower. When we get 1 mile out, it will start flashing 6 times a second. When we're down to 50 feet over the end of the runway, it will burn continuously.
Our blacked-out C-47 is going down at approximately 400 feet a minute, and believe me, that's fast when you're under a hood. In case you're interested in the brains behind this new development, credit for combining these two great safety features goes to Lieutenant Colonel F.L. Mosley, Chief of the Communications and Navigation Laboratory at Wright Field. Thanks to him and the engineers under his direction in the radio and radar subdivision, this new system for easy, safe, blind landings should soon prove a boon to civilian pilots, and in fact to every person who flies in the air age of tomorrow. This is really an eerie feeling, knowing that the Earth is coming up at you and not being able to see it. There goes that light. It's flashing faster now. We've 1 mile to go, and the ground is just 200 feet below. Both pilots are watching their instruments intently. Brother, that ground is getting close. It won't be long now. If everything goes okay, we'll be hitting the runway soon. The light's steady now. The altimeter shows 50 feet. Falling fast. 25 feet now. Get set. Here we go, down to the runway. We made it. We're rolling on the runway. It was a perfect landing. Now let's tear off the hood and look out. Yes, sir, we're lined up perfectly on the runway. And that's how the automatic pilot ties in with the AAF instrument approach system. From Wright Field, we return you now to your AAF in New York.
Thank you, Wright Field, for another notable contribution toward the safety of the future.
Just 10 years ago, Wright Field was already peering into the future, and the first automatic pilots were being tested. 10 years ago, in 1935, when the only piloting most of us were doing was the girlfriend around the dance floor, or steering her outside, to look at such natural phenomena as Sergeant Bob Carroll and the singing voices of the AAF described for you. Blue Moon.
Saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. You knew just what I was there for. Dream in my heart without a love. suddenly appeared before me. The only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold.
Washington, D.C., the Army Air Forces operates the Personnel Services Division, one of whose functions is the matter of insurance. Typical of the questions asked by soldiers and their dependents are those of Mrs. Philip R. Strizek, whose son is now serving in the Philippines with the 5th Air Force. Mrs. Strizek has come here tonight to get some advice concerning her son's National Service Life Insurance. And standing by in Washington, D.C. to help her in this matter is Lieutenant Colonel Lewis J. Grayson, an outstanding authority on the insurance problems of Air Force's personnel. Mrs. Strizek, Colonel Grayson is ready for your first question.
Colonel, my son will soon be a civilian, and we are trying to decide what he should do about his $10,000 National Service Life Insurance. He is single, and he has nobody dependent upon him for support. For his own good, should he keep all his insurance, reduce it, or drop it entirely when he is discharged?
Well, Mrs. Strizek, someday your son will undoubtedly get married and raise a family. When that time comes, he will need and want all the insurance he can carry. However, he may then find himself unable to obtain insurance from a private company except at a very high cost, if at all, because of unsatisfactory physical condition, or because of hazardous employment. He therefore should keep the insurance he now has, at least until such time after discharge from the Army as he can judge his needs and income.
Should he keep it in its present form as long as he can, Colonel Grayson, or convert it now to ordinary life or some other permanent plan?
That is an individual problem, Mrs. Strizek, depending upon your son's ability to pay premiums. The sooner he converts it, the lower the premiums will be. There is an advantage, therefore, in converting his insurance as soon after discharge from the Army, as he is well established in a civilian job and knows what he needs and can afford. Convert to ordinary life, 20-payment life, or 30-payment life.
In the event my son marries after leaving the service, can he name his wife beneficiary in place of me without a lot of red tape?
Yes, by simply sending a written request over his signature to the Veterans Administration, stating his policy number or serial number, his wife's full name, and the amount of insurance.
One last question, Colonel. Does National Service Life Insurance ordinarily cost less than similar insurance with a private company?
In National Service Life Insurance, the government pays all the costs of administration. Also, the government pays all the excess losses due to military or naval service. These savings are passed on to the policyholders. It is probable, therefore, that this government insurance is the lowest cost insurance your son can get for his money.
Thanks very much, Colonel Grayson.
Not at all, Mrs. Strizek. I hope we've helped you and your son.
We return you now to your AAF in New York. To many a returning airman these days, the rhythm of the clicking train wheels makes a kind of music. And here's the air crew to give you an idea of just how that music sounds.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? I think it ought to change.
at the Chesapeake or Santa Fe.
The old folks riding round the bend. I reckon that you know you're gonna meet a friend. Folks are only parts get the time of day.
From the ashes and the peak of the Santa Fe.
Here she comes. Ooh, 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 ooh. Hey, Jim, you better get the red. Ooh, 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 ooh. She's got a list of passengers that's pretty big, and they'll all want to live in the Brown Hotel. Cause lots of them have traveled and for quite a spell, all the way from Philadelphia, on the Yacht to Santa Pega and the Santa Fe. The Yacht to Santa Pega and the Santa Fe.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? Think of that, it's engine 49, the only one that'll sound that way.
On the Yacht to Santa Pega and the Santa Fe.
B-29s wheeled into the air off a Japanese airfield and started on one of the most epoch-making flights in nation history, the first non-stop flight from Japan to America. To hear direct from General Giles, LeMay, and O'Donnell on the object of this flight and their reactions before making it, we take you now by Army wire recorder to Mitsutani Airfield, Japan. Go ahead, Major West.
This is your AAF reporter, Major Carol West, speaking from Mizutani Airfield near Chitose on the island of Hokkaido, Japan. In a few hours, a new era of peacetime long-range air transportation will begin as three B-29s roar down this runway for the start of one of the longest non-stop flights in history, all the way from the Japanese Empire to Washington, D.C. These super fortresses will be flown by three colorful Army Air Forces figures. Lieutenant General Barney M. Giles, Deputy Commander of the United States Army Strategic Air Forces. Major General Curtis E. LeMay, Chief of Staff of the Strategic Air Forces and former Commander of the 20th Air Force. And Brigadier General Emmett O'Donnell, Commander of the Veterans 73rd Bombardment Wing of the 20th Air Force. We have these three men at our wire recording microphone. And they have agreed to supply some information about this flight. General Giles, just what is the purpose of this flight?
The purpose of this flight is to study the feasibility of using the northern route between Japan and the United States, paying particular attention to communication, navigation, and weather.
General Giles, how long do you think it would take a person to make the same trip by the usual water and land route?
I would say from 4 to 5 weeks.
Sir, how much gasoline will you each be carrying when you take off?
Each airplane will have slightly more than 10,000 gallons of gasoline.
Well, figuring about 6.5 pounds per gallon, that will be around 65,000 pounds weight or 32 tons. Is that right?
Yes, you are correct.
How long is this airstrip, General LeMay?
8,200 feet long.
Is that plenty of room for you to get airborne with your load?
Not plenty, but it's adequate.
Is the runway in pretty good condition, sir?
Yes, this aerodrome has never been bombed, so the runway is in fairly good condition.
General O'Donnell, why was this airfield picked for the start of the flight?
It was selected because it's the only aerodrome in Japan which is adequate for fully loaded B-29 takeoffs.
Did the Japanese use this field for long-range air operations?
Not to our knowledge, but we understand that the Japanese had a project for launching one-way, four-engine bomber kamikaze attacks from this field against our aircraft industry on the West Coast.
Sir, what proportion of the flight will be over water?
Approximately one-third of it.
General LeMay, do you anticipate good weather all the way?
In making a flight of this distance, it's impossible to find atmospheric conditions that will give you good weather throughout the entire route. We expect to have bad weather over a portion of the route.
How were your crews picked for this flight, General Giles?
All of these crews completed 35 missions or more against the enemy, and they were scheduled to go back to the States on normal rotation.
One more question, sir. Will you carry our wire recording to Washington in your B-29?
Yes, Major West. We will be very glad to accommodate you.
Thank you, Lieutenant General Barney M. Giles, Major General Curtis E. LeMay, and Brigadier General Emmett O'Donnell, for giving us information on your history-making flight. May we wish you good luck and Godspeed. This is your AAF reporter returning you to the United States.
In the lead plane of this flight, carried from Japan to Washington in a matter of some 28 hours, was the wire recording you have just heard. In Washington, to pick it up and to cover the landing, was our AAF reporter, Captain Howard Finch. For his eyewitness report of the landing, we take you now by Army wire recorder to Washington and Captain Howard Finch.
This is your AAF reporter, Captain Howard Finch, speaking from the Gravelly Point Airport of the ATC in Washington, D.C. Yesterday at 4:01 p.m. Eastern Wartime, three silver battle-tested B-29s roared off the runways of Mitsutani Field and the Japanese home islands of Hokkaido and headed toward the United States on a great circle route that was destined to carry them over one quarter of the distance around the Earth's surface. Fierce headwinds were encountered over northern Canada today, which necessitated the use of more fuel than anticipated, with the result that the Super Fort landed at Chicago, refueled, and just a few moments ago landed in Washington, and are now taxiing to the apron here in front of the ATC terminal. And the crowd is milling around. The first man out of the B-29, Lieutenant General Barney Giles. He looks a little tired, but he's smiling and seems very happy. And we're going to try and get our microphones up here where we can pick up some of the official greeting. The crew of the first B-29 in are now beginning to file out of the airplane. There is a terrific crowd milling around the plane now, and congratulations being roared out. Bands are playing in the background. The individual members of the crew are being congratulated. General Arnold is talking to General Giles. And now one of the crew members of the B-29s that have just landed. What is your name?
Leo Miller, sir.
And what's your rank, Leo?
Staff Sergeant.
And what was your job on the B-29?
I was one of the two radio operators that came along to carry on communications between air-to-air and air-to-ground.
And which ship, Sergeant?
Number 3, sir.
Where's your hometown?
Brooklyn, New York.
Now, how does it feel to be back now?
It feels great to be back in civilization again, for one thing.
Where were you stationed, Sergeant?
Saipan in the Marianas, 73rd Wing.
And what are your plans for the future?
Well, I intend to go to college, University of Minnesota to be exact.
I'm the flight sergeant. What was the one thing that thrilled you perhaps the most?
Well, we saw three Russian fighter planes up by Siberia that recognized us and rattled their wings and then took off. And it was great to look down on those American cities again, Chicago and Washington at night.
Good. Thank you very much, Sergeant. And now, ladies and gentlemen, General of the Army H.H. Arnold.
I want to tell you, Barney, and Rosie, and Kurt, that I'm very proud of the flight that you made. The crews and the planes and the leaders all lived up to our expectations. We knew that the B-29 was good because we saw what happened in Japan. But we didn't know whether or not it could make this long flight back to the United States. And in spite of the headwinds, you made a wonderful flight. And I want to congratulate all of you.
General Arnold, thanks very much for your congratulations.
You not only think the airplane is all right, I talked to a number of Jap pilots and the head of the Japanese Air Force. He said the B-29 the best bomber in the world.
General Arnold,
you ought to know.
General Arnold, what is the true significance of this flight from Japan to the United States?
The true significance of the flight was to give a real workout to the B-29 to see what it could do in the way of traveling long distances and so we could get some idea of the distance to be covered and the time it would require to cover the distances. We need that information for the future to figure out just what we can expect of airplanes of this type.
Thank you, sir. General LeMay, anything of an unusual nature happen on the flight?
No, everything functioned perfectly. If it hadn't been for the headwind, we'd been here. Actually, we flew more air miles than was necessary to make the trip.
Where did you first hit the headwind?
We hit them all the way. I was 20 miles all the way across.
Thank you, sir. General O'Donnell, at what height did you fly coming across in the main?
We started out rather low and worked up to 25,000 feet, which is the highest we attained.
And landing in Chicago and coming into Washington, what height did you fly in from there?
We flew in formation at 9,000 feet.
Anything of an unusual nature?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all, except that we were intercepted by two Russian fighter pilots in P-63s off Kamchatka, who gave us a big high ball and waved their wings at us and sent us on our way.
And the United States looked mighty, mighty good.
It surely does.
Thank you, sir. And that about concludes the ceremonies of welcoming these three heroic crews who have landed here at Gravelly Airport of the ATC in the nation's capital at Washington, D.C. We return you now to your AAF in New York.
To keep the peace, to pioneer the future, this is your AAF. During the last half hour, you've been listening to the official program of the Army Air Forces, your AAF, which came to you from New York City. This is the American Broadcasting Company. Which came to you from New York City. This is the American Broadcasting Company.